So my name is Claudia Horowitz, and I'm 46 years old. I've lived in North Carolina for 20 years, and I'm in a big transition year. I've been the founding director of an organization called Stone Circles at the Stone House, which sits on 70 acres of land here in Mebane, North Carolina, which is about 20 minutes outside of Chapel Hill. And over the next 6 months or so, I'm going to be transitioning out of that role as executive director, which has kind of defined a lot of the last two decades of my life. So it's an exciting time, full of the requisite, you know, anxiety and curiosity. This is the first time I've ever lived on land as opposed to in a city or in a suburb. It's been really life-changing, and I've really developed a pretty deep relationship with this piece of land and just the rhythms of nature in general that I never had before. So that feels really important. So I did a lot of community service in college, and when I was graduating from college, I got a job as an organizer, and it was kind of my introduction to politics and, more importantly, community organizing. And I learned quite a bit about poverty issues, specifically economic justice, and was involved as an organizer around those issues for a few years. And in addition to learning a lot about the political system and how change happens from the outside, the power of grassroots organizing, I also, kind of as a parallel track of awareness and awakening, saw a lot of the ravages of social change work in people's lives, the burnout, the addiction, the illness, mental and physical, and just the reality that folks were having a hard time sustaining themselves in their work for all those reasons. And so at some point, a series of light bulbs kind of started to go off in my head, and there was this kind of developing sense of concern about the future of social movements and how it is that people are able to bring a greater level of sustainability to their work. And that's what inspired me to start Stone Circles in 1996. I had been on my own spiritual path for a couple years, maybe 2 or 3 years, and had already really seen a lot of the benefits of a meditation practice, you know, a daily meditation practice. And there was a beautiful, elegant mystery to how that daily practice of mindfulness kind of changed my day. And I was really struck by it, like really taken by it. And I immediately saw it as like this huge resource for people doing social justice work. And that was what was really the kind of initial inspiration for starting Stone Circles. Like the question was like, how can we strengthen the inner or spiritual foundation of individual leaders who are working for change, organizations, collectives, etc. And so that was the beginning of the organization. I had been running Stone Circles for about 10 years before we moved to the land that we're on now. I always wanted us to have a center, a physical space where people could come. I think there's a lot of power in physical space. One, as a convening space, like to have neutral space where people from many different backgrounds and walks of life and demographics can actually find some, I don't want to say neutral meeting ground, but a common meeting ground. There's this notion of the third place. You have your work, you have your home, and then you have a series of third places where you gather with people kind of outside of those two primary domains of home and work. And so the idea was to kind of create a third place. And we took a lot of inspiration from some really different sources in building this place. We took some inspiration from what function ashrams and monasteries play in a lot of cultures, spaces where people can really devote themselves to spiritual practice, where there's been a devotion to spiritual practice, so the energy, the container is there for that, it's held for that purpose. Everything is set up to enable that more easily. That was definitely one stream. And then there are these kind of centers of movement building where people gather to strategize in a different way to get out of their normal day-to-day context, talk with people they wouldn't normally talk with, think differently than they would normally think. And I think what's been really powerful about this place, we had this notion of kind of radical hospitality that evolved very early on here at the Stone House. And really, there's a lot of ways to define that, but I think what it really means is just providing a really open-hearted, generous sense of welcome to everyone who comes through here, no matter why they're here, no matter who they are, and in some ways, most importantly, no matter what state they arrive in. Some people get here, they're exhausted. Some people are fired up. Some people are reluctant. And it's all, there's just a sense like everybody is welcome and everybody's wanted. And I think that's made a huge difference in terms of how people enter and then the land begins to work on them, the open space, the simplicity of the pasture, the bits of trees, the little nooks and crannies on the land where no one will find you or no one will disturb you if they do find you. There's a lot that people experience and feel here, even though they might never be able to put words to it, but it becomes like a touchstone of something. And I've had so many people say, like, the minute they enter the driveway, something happens to their physical being. The breath drops a little bit. They feel their shoulders relax. You know, something transpires, and that's really powerful. So I am in the middle of this big transition. I'm going to leave the role of executive director, but I'm going to stay connected to the organization. We're at an interesting juncture. It's actually quite challenging to make places like this work financially. Centers with land tend to have large endowments or large institutions backing them up, church, university, whatever. We don't have that. We have, you know, the support of individuals and some income we earn from renting the space, et cetera. I feel really great about the work I've done here so far and the work we've all done. And it needs a next phase of leadership for someone to create greater financial sustainability. And I have other work that I want to do. I think that there are a lot of challenges to being an executive director. It's kind of inherently a role of distraction. You're constantly bouncing from one task to another and having to keep a lot of different balls in the air. And I'm pretty good at that. And I don't mind it so much all the time, but what it does is make the more focused creative work more challenging. And I'm really interested in being able to kind of devote more of my time and energy to teaching, training, writing. Those are really my passions. I grew up in a suburb, and in the suburbs, you know, houses are fairly close together. If you're lucky, there's a sense of neighborhood, and there was in my childhood to some extent. And whatever piece of earth you live on in a suburb, there's a very distinct separation between inside and outside. I feel like the outside of our house growing up was tended to in a way that was really about supporting what was happening in the house and how the house looked and all that. What's been so powerful about living on 70 acres, a lot of which is untamed or unmanicured, unlandscaped, is that there is a whole other power that takes over. And it's hard to talk about it without falling into the cliches about nature in some ways, but nature is probably the most powerful agent of change that there is. It's very predictable in some ways, less predictable in others, but there's a predictability to seasons. There's a predictability to what animals will do at certain times of the year. There's a predictability to the cycle of the moon, to what blooms when, to who eats what. And then there's all these really unpredictable events. What happens when there's a drought? What happens when there's a huge snowstorm? What happens when the climate, you know, the planet heats up a little bit and things bloom at different times and the ecosystem freaks out a little bit? What happens when there's a big storm and a huge tree falls? And what does that tree become in an ecosystem? So I love that interplay of predictability and, you know, surprise. And there's something so simultaneously comforting and discomforting about this force that is so much larger and so completely out of human control, try as we will, you know, to try to control it. I love that, you know, even though there's things about it that are terrifying at times, I love it. And I think the most powerful thing about being on land is how land kind of receives what humans bring to it. And if you're having some kind of right relationship with land, like we're trying to do here, the land pretty much receives whatever you offer it. It receives the pain that people bring to it. It receives the joy. It receives the changes. And it just kind of keeps on going. And there's something so solid and amazing and beautiful about that, that just has the potential, if we're in touch with it, to like shift all of our perspective on anything else that might be going on. I remember Y2K, so that year when we were turning the clocks from 1999 to 2000, and everybody was kind of freaking out and worried about what would happen and this kind of technological computer, you know, breakdown that might occur. And I was at the beach with a bunch of friends, and right around midnight, we were outside on the deck. It was really gorgeous weather here in North Carolina. And I just remember like gazing out at the ocean and having the deepest belly laugh that I'd had in so long. Because for the ocean, which has been like a touchstone for me since I was a child, Y2K was like a myth. You know, it was irrelevant. It was beyond irrelevant. And something really shifted for me in that moment of just realizing that no matter what we try to do as humans, and some of what we try to do is really great in terms of control and boundaries and all these kinds of things, like nature will always kind of win out with its own big ideas, you know? I love that. I think the word peace is really complicated. I think it has a lot of different meanings for different people, which is one of the reasons why this project is so interesting to me that you're doing. For me, the only valuable relationship to peace is the really complex one. For me, that means like, what is that intrinsic relationship between however we might describe an inner peace or an internal sense of peace with the most global possibilities around peace in the most unlikely places, actual spaces of conflict, of war, of violence, of oppression, of poverty. And it's that spectrum, and I would say more importantly, that kind of inextricable link for me that sort of embodies really why it's even worthwhile to talk about peace. I think that there are words in society that have been used so often and so many times that they can really easily lose their meaning. And I think peace is in danger of being one of them. I think what comes up for me a lot with this is how folks forget or ignore or avoid the other layers of meaning of the word peace other than the one they're most focused on. And what I mean by that is I've seen a lot of people head down a spiritual path. They're searching for some kind of inner peace, whether they talk about it that way or not, and many do. And there's very little, if any, recognition of the larger societal forces that are at play that are intimately related to their own search for peace and the kind of collective search for inner peace. And conversely, the opposite is true. It's really heartbreaking to hear people talk about peace on a global scale without any real shred of recognition of what that would entail internally. And so where I get most interested in this is those sort of messy places where all these different understandings of peace begin to intersect. And how is it that people are fortifying some kind of inner fire or inner calm, or really just the ability to be fully present to what is unfolding in the moment, which I think brings in some ways the greatest peace. I'm speaking as someone that has been largely on a Buddhist path, like that for me is the source of internal peace, is that just willingness to sit with reality as it's unfolding over time. But how do we bring that into the mix with a commitment to collective liberation and where peace fits into that? So that feels really vital to me. And I think the other thing I would say is that I'm pretty sure peace is a process. I think it's sort of like balance. Like nothing is really ever in balance for very long. The very essence of balance is that we're almost always out of balance and moving back into it, whether it's a human searching for balance or an object. And I think peace is similar. It's just as easily defined by the process of moving away and toward as it is the static state, because the static state is so fleeting. So it's the process of moving to and from, that process of moving to and from, that I think is like infinitely more interesting. I think in some ways, like a good chunk of my life is directed towards the work for peace on that individual and collective level, although I may not necessarily label it that way. I would say that one of the most important things I try to do on a daily basis is to be a presence in spaces that actually inspires a greater level of peace within other people, which is not to say that it's an avoidance of conflict. And I think that's one of the myths of peace, is that you can either have peace or you can have conflict. But I think ideally, I work day to day to be a presence that allows people in some ways to feel enough peace with themselves and with a situation as it's unfolding that they can be authentic. And sometimes, you know, that means leading to hard conversations or whatever needs to happen. So I think that's a big thing. Something I really enjoy doing and I think I'm pretty good at is creating a context or a situation where people can drop down into a greater reservoir of peace within themselves pretty quickly. So I've been, you know, meditating for a long time and gently guiding people into quiet spaces. And I've really learned how to take a situation that might be a little chaotic or frenetic or conflictual or whatever, and just invite people to shift their awareness a bit, and shifting that awareness to the breath, to the belly. Really, it's amazing what impact that can have on both individuals and a group. And there's a way in which that allows folks to come back to something, to themselves, to each other, from a different place. And it doesn't mean like shoving challenges under the rug. I mean, if you're doing social change work, there's just always going to be challenges. But I'm really interested in how people bring the best of themselves to those challenges, as opposed to like their shadow, which is often what folks end up leading with. It's very triggering, the work for change. You know, there's a lot of frustration, there's a lot of urgency, there's anger, there's not enough resources. And I sometimes feel like we're just in this place of like being triggered a lot into our, well, what the yogic tradition would call like our lower selves or something. So I feel like a lot of the work for peace for me is gently but firmly kind of nudging people to drop a little bit deeper so that they can reconnect with this like reservoir of goodness and possibility and just space that exists within them. And for me, a lot of the work for peace is like opening up some space, whether it's within or between or among folks. Sometimes I worry that some of our most powerful and important ideas become words that are used to actually paper over like a deeper level of exploration and analysis. And sometimes I have that fear with the word peace. I think that we need to be really rigorous in our understanding of peace, and we need to be really specific. And if we're going to talk about peace, we need to talk about what kinds of peace we're talking about. And we need to like really be kind of unflinching in our ability to articulate that and put it on the table. So that's definitely a concern I have. And I think the other is I feel like folks are talking about it less and less in these ways that I find really fascinating and sort of alarming. Sometimes I wonder if we've given up a little bit, like if we've given up on the possibility of peace. And we are settling for whatever else is possible. Occupation, you know, some low level of conflict, making ourselves comfortable with proportional response, you know, whatever the thing is in terms of the global arena. And I really wonder about that. Like, have we given in to the darker side of our nature in some unconscious way that we're not totally aware of? And we've been sort of complicit, but do we really want to do that? Like, can we salvage the birthright of humanity, which I think is much more about kind of collective freedom? And I don't know. I think it's a really big question. I'm not a pessimist in any way. I have a lot. I'm not sure I would call myself an optimist either, but I don't have any kind of doomsday scenario, or I don't think like that in any way. But I do see patterns, and this is a pattern that I've seen over time, that we have been less and less willing to put the best possible scenario in the center and to aim for that. I think we've really started to settle. I think some of our stumbling blocks stem from a lack of reflection. And I really mean that with like a very large capital R. I think that there are ancestral, cultural, and political legacies that survive and thrive because they're not interrupted with some kind of searing, reflective lens. There are so many things that we do almost by default without examination that create greater tension, greater separation between humans. And without this willingness to reflect on what some of these patterns are, I think we're in trouble. But if we could continue to build an internal and collective capacity for awareness of some of those legacies and patterns and how they're limiting our ability to thrive, I think it would go a long way. I don't think it's an easy thing to do. I think it's a really hard thing to do in some ways. The most compelling experiences of peace for me are almost always amidst conflict or great suffering, sort of the times when you might least expect it. And I don't think I really realized that until just now, thinking about this. So for me, the experiences of peace that are really compelling are collective mourning, collective outpouring of some kind of emotion and reweaving after something terrible has happened. And similarly, in an individual, when someone has been through something really intense and started to come out the other side of that, whether it's a reckoning with oneself, a reckoning with another person, there's a feeling in the body that happens after a really good cry that I think most folks that have had a good cry will recognize. And it's a very powerful moment after that happens. And there's a way in which some element of karma has been loosened. Something has been let go of. Some past experience that has been stored in the body has been released. And there's space. And I think most of us know that feeling. We've had it, even if very rarely in our lives. And I think for me, that's like the most potent form of peace. When there's been a reckoning with something really hard or really painful, and because of the willingness and the bravery to turn in towards that, it ushers in this space that we didn't realize was actually possible until we got there. And then we actually can see with fresh eyes, like what's around us. And that's really potent. That's a really potent expression of peace to me, because it's an acknowledgement of reality. It's an acknowledgement of suffering, which is an inevitable part of human existence. But it's not a giving in to that suffering. It's a willingness to turn toward it, to be in it, to move through it and then to see what exists on the other side of it. Well, I think one of the most important things I would say about peace is how important I think it is to embody it. And I think that there's a fruitlessness to kind of working for peace if you don't have some sense of what it means to actually live it or be it. There's this amazing quote from Marguerite Duras, who was a writer during about the French Resistance. And the line is just, there will never be justice anywhere until you yourself are justice now. I think of that line all the time, and I think you could just substitute peace in there. There will never be peace anywhere unless you yourself are peace now. It doesn't mean that activity around peace is for naught without the embodiment, but it's got way less staying power and impact. And I think that one of my biggest desires is to close that gap between the kind of search for internal peace and that more, you know, search for peace out in the world, and to really make some linkages there that are kind of unbreakable for folks. Because I think that's like our best hope.